Anne Broadbent and Douglas Stabila, and we just got it up on the archive recently. First question, what is a one-time program? So first of all, I'm going to have to summarize what's known about classical one-time programs. So we're going to spend 5 minutes talking about purely classical stuff here, just to give us a grounding. So what is a one-time program? Well, it's a cryptographic primitive that allows two parties to evaluate some publicly known function, and this function could be specified by a Turing machine or a Boolean circuit or whatever. And this function maps pairs of bit strings to bit strings in such a way that, so you've got these two parties here, you've got the sender and the receiver, all right? They each have their own separate input string, and the sender is going to send a message to the receiver, okay? And then the sender is going to go away. So the sender's message to the receiver then serves as kind of like instructions for a program by which the receiver can, shove his input into this program and get the output. And then the interesting part happens now. Once the receiver's got his output, we want this behavior. Bang, poof, okay? The receiver learns nothing beyond that which could be inferred from one-shot access to some kind of idealized oracle for this function f here with this x parameter fixed. Okay, so this is the one-time property that we seek. Okay, so just to quickly list off some potential applications, software protection, digital rights management, electronic cash, maybe a one-time program could be kind of like a coin that cannot be double spent, for example. So just for example here, here's a screen capture of this TextPoint add-on that I use to render LaTeX and PowerPoint. And if maybe you can see that it's been unlicensed on my machine for 2,214 straight days. So maybe if they had some kind of software protection, they could prevent me from doing this if they cared enough. So, yeah. Okay. So, there are many ways that you might formalize this abstract idea of a one-time program. So why did I choose this one? Why this two-party model? Well, phrasing it this way kind of makes it clear this is really a special type of multi-party computation, which is a familiar primitive in the cryptographic community, and it's received a lot of study, so it's nice to put it within that framework. So in this talk, then, when I say the words one-time program, I really mean non-interactive two-party computation, where the non-interactive obviously refers to the fact that you have communication only in one direction from the sender to the receiver. Okay. So the first observation that anyone makes whenever they hear this idea is that software can always be copied, so this is obviously impossible. And indeed, that's true. I mean, if you think about it for a moment, like, this guy's going to send to this guy instructions for calculating f. I mean, all he can do is ask him to please use it only once, and then you have to trust that this guy will do that. So we need some kind of assumptions in order to make this work, such as quantum mechanics or secured hardware or something like that. Okay, so, this raises the interesting question then, because quantum information in general cannot be copied, so you might wonder that perhaps we could use quantum information alone would suffice to implement these one-time programs. But a moment's thought reveals that no, this isn't actually the case, because some adversary who acts reversibly can always recover any program state sent to him by a sender in order to use it to evaluate f multiple times. So here's your program state psi, this was given by the sender, and you just do a unitary, and so you've got this classical basis state with your out value of your function, which you can then copy without disturbing the system, and then just run the inverse to recover the program state again. Okay, so quantum information alone does not give you this one-time property. So we're left with secure hardware assumptions. Okay, so classical one-time programs then, it's known, can be constructed from a very basic hypothetical hardware device that's called a one-time memory, and I'll elaborate a little bit on those results shortly. But first, let me talk about this device. So we're going to assume then that you've got this secure box, and it contains inside two secret bits of information. And the user then can access these bits, but only through the input-output interface to the box and nothing else. So he selects one of the two bits that he would like to learn, the value of that bit, and he receives the value of that bit, and then bang, poof. The value of the other bit inside the box is lost forever, and you can never recover it. Okay, so that's it. That's the device. It's very simple, very basic. Advantages of this kind of simple device is that, if you're going to base the security of some crypto system on some hardware assumption, you better be darn sure that you can actually build those pieces of hardware securely. And the simpler the device, the easier it is to, you know, ensure that you can do this. Another advantage of these guys is that these things are independent of the context in which they're used, and so they could be mass-produced ahead of time, which is a nice property. Okay, so what's already known then about classical one-time programs? Well, there exist one-time programs for any function f using these one-time memories, and these one-time programs are secure against any malicious receiver and against any malicious sender. And these are information theoretic security, so you place no restrictions on your adversaries here. It's still secure. Moreover, they achieve this universally composable property, which is kind of the strongest possible security that you could ask of these things. Okay, so these facts were established in this combination of papers here by those authors. Okay, so with that under our belts, we can finally start talking about quantum stuff. The immediate generalization to quantum information is we have this publicly known channel now acting on a bipartite input, and it produces an output, and it's specified. We're going to assume it's specified by some quantum circuit in some fixed basis, fixed universal set of gates. So as before, we've got this sender and this receiver, and they each have their own portions of some joint input in an arbitrary state row, and the sender is going to send some communication to the receiver. And this communication is going to serve as a program by which the receiver evaluates the action of this channel. And he gets the output of phi on the input row. And then, we want that the receiver learns nothing beyond that which can be inferred from one-shot access to kind of an idealized functionality for this channel given the input register A. Okay, so that's what we want. Okay, so I'm going to give a slide stating our results on one-time programs, and I'm going to do it by making some little corrections to this previous slide from the results on classical one-time programs. So here's that slide again, and here are our results. So there exists quantum one-time programs for any channel now using the very same basic one-time memory devices. And they're secure against any malicious receiver and universally composable. They're not secure against any malicious sender. We just simply didn't get to that. So that's kind of a future project. I have some ideas on how one might do this, but we don't quite know how to shut the door. And indeed, I was talking with Daniel about this earlier today. So what's really interesting is that we don't need any kind of, you know, quantum one-time memory, whatever that might be. You just use the same basic classical devices to achieve these quantum one-time programs. So I think that's interesting. Okay, so that's our primary result. And I'm going to spend, you know, the bulk of the talk talking about that, and then hopefully, if there's time, I'll get to the rest. So I don't know how long we have this room, but we'll see how it goes. Okay, so just in a little more detail then, so what exactly is a one-time program? So you've got your two parties. Your sender gets his input, and he uses that input to prepare a bunch of quantum states and a bunch of these one-time memory devices, and he shuttles them off to the receiver. And the sender goes away. He's gone now. So you're left with the receiver who's got his portion of the input state and these states and one-time memories that he received from the sender. Okay, so he's going to look at these states and, you know, query some of these one-time memories. And we would like then, for if the receiver is honest, at the end of the day, there must be a way for him to hold in his hands a bunch of smoldering, used-up one-time memory devices and a register containing the action of phi on the input row. Okay, so that's if he's honest, he must be able to at least do that. Moreover, we have the security requirement there, which specifies in a little bit more formality now that for any receiver, honest or otherwise, there must exist a simulator that uses only one-shot access to an idealized functionality for phi here that mimics the behavior of the sender's quantum one-time program from the viewpoint of this malicious receiver here. So basically, the contents of this bubble here, as accessed through this interface, should look exactly the same to this guy as the contents of this bubble here, as accessed through this interface. And, you know, this is a simulation-based definition of security. This is quite popular in cryptographic circles. Basically, the idea is that if that's the case, then, you know, anything that a malicious receiver could possibly learn from the sender's one-time program, he could equally well learn by just interacting with this simulator, which, of course, only makes an idealized call to this functionality here, and so it follows then that it must be the case that he can't learn anything more than what can be learned from this. And that's really what we want. Okay? Okay, so if there's time, I'll return to these simulation-based definitions of security later, because there's actually a lot that can be said about them. But for now, we're gonna leave that for a bit. Okay, so I'm gonna talk about how we construct our quantum one-time program, and how an honest receiver would use that one-time program to actually recover the action of the channel on his state. Okay, here's a five-point plan for how we're gonna proceed. Don't bother, you know, trying to read all these right now, because these will appear as titles of slides later on. But there's a five-point plan. So, point one of the five-point plan. So first, we're gonna use these one-time memories to build what we call a reactive classical one-time program. So this is nothing deep here. So recall that the sender's message, which is the quantum one-time program, consists of qubits and these one-time memory devices. Now, I've already told you that it's known that you can use those one-time memory devices to produce these classical one-time programs that are secure. So it's safe for us to assume that, in fact, the sender's message contains quantum states and classical one-time programs. Moreover, it's actually not too difficult to show that you can combine these classical one-time programs in such a way as to create kind of a reactive program that where you can interact with it for a fixed number of messages before it self-destructs. Okay? So what we're going to do then is we're going to assume that the sender's message actually consists of states plus a reactive classical one-time program. Okay, so that's point number one. Point number two, step number two. We're gonna do a little bit of a digression here to talk about these quantum authentication schemes. So I'm not sure how many people in this audience are already familiar with this stuff, but I'll talk about it anyway. So the idea is that you wanna encode and decode, you want an encoding scheme for quantum information indexed by classical key K, such that any tampering on encoded data can be detected with high probability over the choice of key K. So this is reminiscent of error correction, except for it's a little bit stronger now because you have malicious noise here, malicious tampering of your encoded state. And you want to be able to detect any tampering whatsoever with high probability. Okay, so these were introduced in 2002 by these authors. And so we're going to restrict attention in this talk to a special type of authentication scheme, which we call encode-encrypt schemes. And they have basically the following specific form, where in order to authenticate data, you start by encoding according to some randomly selected code chosen from some special family. And then you encrypt using a random poly P. So then the classical key for codes of this type is a description of the code that you've selected and a description of the poly encryption that's applied on top. And this is just the authentication algorithm here. It's really simple. Okay, and similar for deauthentication, you just invert the poly, invert the encoding, and you measure the syndrome registers, and any non-zero outcome indicates tampering. Okay, so why pay attention to encode-encrypt schemes? Well, because they make life really easy. One of the really nice properties is that any attack on an encode-encrypt authentication scheme is actually equivalent to a mixture of poly attacks on the underlying family of codes. I'll explain what that means in a moment. But that's really nice because you kind of discretize the space of all attacks that could possibly occur. So given that then, it's the case that any family of codes that is secure against poly attacks therefore immediately induces a secure encode-encrypt authentication scheme. So you kind of reduce the problem of finding a secure authentication scheme to simply finding a family of codes that's secure against poly attacks. And I'll clarify that in a moment. Moreover, as a byproduct, the task of formally defining security for an arbitrary authentication scheme is actually a little bit tricky. But when we restrict attention to these encode-encrypt schemes, it becomes much easier because, again, you've discretized the set of possible attacks. So you're really, it's just easier to formalize that. Okay, so we introduce in this paper a family of codes that we call trap codes. Now I say introduce because, well, these were apparently first used implicitly in this Shor Preskill proof of BB84, but we can at least say that we're formalizing these and making them accessible for the first time. Anyway, the idea is you're gonna base your family on any code E, which at least we'll assume that it's a stabilizer code just for the convenient properties of stabilizer codes. So any code E that encodes one qubit into N with distance D. All right, and we're gonna construct a family of codes that encode one qubit into 3N with distance D. And they're indexed by permutations, and it's real simple. You just encode according to E, and then you add a bunch of plus states and a bunch of zero states, and you randomly scramble them about according to some permutation pi. And that's your encoded data, okay? Okay, so then I claim then that this family of codes is secure against poly attacks. In particular, given the distance D of the underlying code, any poly that acts non-trivially on logical data will be detected by this scheme as an error with, will not be detected with probability smaller than this, which of course is decreasing exponentially in D, which is really what you want, which gives you the security that you require. So this is actually not hard to show for the trap codes here. So the proof is that in order to act non-trivially, any such poly must have weight at least D, and so to avoid detection, Q has to kind of distribute somehow at least D non-identity polys over all the qubits, but they're randomly scrambled, so it's going to be hard to do that while avoiding all of the traps. So like if you apply, you know, an X to a zero qubit, it's going to become a one and you'll detect that, right? So a simple analysis shows that the probability of actually succeeding at distributing these guys without hitting any of the traps is at most 2/3 to the D over 2. And it's probably even a lot smaller than that, but this is just for the sake of a simple analysis, you still get this bound. And all that really matters is that it's exponentially small in D. Okay, so an immediate corollary then is that these trap codes induce a secure encoded crypto authentication scheme. And the classical key for this scheme is this pair where the first guy is a permutation telling you which code to use. And of course, the second pair is a poly, this description of the poly. Okay, step number three then is this quantum computing on authenticated data.
So the error correcting code uses fixed.
Yes, the underlying code is fixed. So all we're doing is permuting it, basically. So the next tool in our toolbox that we'll need is this idea of quantum computing on authenticated data. So the goal is that you're going to have some possibly malicious attacker here who's holding some authenticated qubit or qubits or whatever. And you've got some guy who knows the classical key K here. And you want to be able to have a way by which this guy can update his key K in such a way that this guy, if he wants to, could apply some operation to the authenticated data that is equivalent to a logical operation under this new key K prime. Okay? So, you know, this G could be some gate from some universal set, and if you can do this for, you know, a universal gate set, then you can get universal computation. Moreover, by updating the key in this way, you effectively force an attacker to apply this operation, as otherwise the state would fail verification under the new updated key K prime. Okay, so this is actually a pretty powerful way to control an adversary who's got your authenticated data. So that's the requirement. That's what we want. So just as an example of a gate that you can do easily is the C naught for the trap scheme. So if you base your trap scheme on a CSS code, then you can show that the controlled NOT gate emits a simple bitwise implementation as described here. And this just follows straightforwardly from the fact that every CSS code emits such an implementation of controlled NOT. And the key update rule, you have to update the poly key according to the familiar action of the controlled NOT on polys. And of course, the permutation stays the same. And it's actually important that you use the same permutation for each encoded qubit, authenticated qubit, but it's okay because each poly encryption is fresh and uniform for each one, so you still retain some security here. Okay, so you cannot get universal set of gates with a simple bitwise implementation, and this is very reminiscent from the study of error correction and fault tolerance. In fact, a lot of this stuff is borrowed from that, in case you haven't noticed. But we can achieve universality by having simple little gadgets that use these magic states. So for the trap scheme, I'm just going to show you how you implement this Clifford K gate here, which is an I-shift phase gate. So here's a logical circuit for implementing K. And if this looks familiar to you, it's because it's a simple modification of the familiar circuit for implementing the pi over 8 phase rotation that's familiar from fault tolerance. So the idea is that So here's your magic state. It must be in this state. And here's your data qubit, and these are authenticated. I just showed you that we know how to do a controlled knot, right? So we need a way to measure authenticated data in the standard basis. And if we have that, then this poly y correction, well, actually poly gates can be implemented on authenticated data just by updating the poly key without the adversary having to do anything. So we can do that. So all we need is to be able to do is measure data, authenticated data in the standard basis, and then we can use this logical circuit to implement the K-gate. Okay. So measurement then. It turns out that any encoding crypt scheme based on a family of CSS codes admits measurement of authenticated data. And so the trap scheme is a family of CSS codes, provided that the underlying code E is a CSS code. So the idea is that the malicious attacker wants to, you know, measure his authenticated qubit, and in order to do that, he just measures bitwise each of the physical qubits and reports those results to the guy who knows the key here. And the guy who knows the key uses his knowledge of the key to decode the result using a purely classical process. And if he wants to, he can send the logical result of that measurement back to the attacker in case he needs to know it. And of course, if this malicious guy tries to tamper with his measurement results, that's equivalent to an attack on the system, which this guy will detect with high probability of the choice of key K. So using these tools, you can construct gadgets for a universal gate set. And I'm not going to go through the details of every gate in our universal set. But suffice it to say that any quantum circuit can be implemented on authenticated data given a classical interaction with some guy who knows the key. And of course, given suitably prepared magic states. Okay, so this isn't brand new. This has actually been known before. So there are a handful of authentication schemes that admit this property of QCAD. The first one is this polynomial scheme, which was constructed incidentally for this multi-party quantum computation cryptographic primitive. It is also an encoding crypt scheme. It acts on higher dimensional QDITs, where the dimension of the system dictates the security of your authentication scheme. Very recently, these guys came up, showed that this so-called Clifford authentication scheme also admits computing on authenticated data. I haven't had too much time to study their paper. And of course, to this list, we add the trap scheme, which is an encoding crypt scheme. It's a relatively simple scheme. It acts just on qubits. Okay, so this has been known before, but like, you know, we kind of maybe help clarify this knowledge of this QCAD idea in our paper, because it's kind of like you really had to dig if you wanted to find this out in existing literature, I guess. Okay, so step four of our five-step plan. We can now, with these tools under our belt, we can come back to quantum one-time programs. Okay, so the idea then is that you've got a way for the receiver to implement gates on his data. So if you suppose for the moment that somehow he was able to get the input registers authenticated, somehow. Given that, and some magic states and some ancilla qubits necessary for, you know, a unitary circuit that might implement this channel phi. Given that, he can perform gates on his data and interact with some classical program as needed. And the beautiful part is that this is just classical interaction, so all of this stuff can be encapsulated in a classical one-time program. So the sender doesn't actually have to be there to do this. He can just program it all into his classical one-time program and go away. Okay, so that's the high level idea of what we're going to do here. So then it remains to just kind of answer this question of how the receiver non-interactively authenticates and deauthenticates his input without learning the key. So we do this by these magical states here, which are, I guess you can think of them as teleport through authenticate and teleport through deauthenticate states. So if you want to authenticate a single qubit, you start with a single EPR pair, and you encode one half of it, and then you do your random poly as per the specification of your encoding crypt scheme, and then this guy is your teleport through authenticate state. And you do something similar for teleporting through a deauthentication, where at the end you just throw the syndrome qubits in the trash. Okay, so there's some cleaning up that needs to do here to account for these teleport through states. In particular, so an honest user, if he's going to teleport his state through the authentication state, then he's going to conduct a Bell measurement and get some some results of his Bell measurement that indicate that a random poly that was applied to his data as he teleported it through here. So basically, this poly serves to kind of re-encrypt the data. So the classical one-time program needs to know this poly so that it can update its internal secret key. Okay, so you need to, so an honest receiver would then inform the classical one-time program of his measurement results. Okay, and something similar would happen for deauthentication. Okay, so that's basically it. Okay, so just to kind of recap, so a quantum one-time program consists of two things: authenticated registers and a reactive classical one-time program. So these registers include, the sender is going to authenticate his own input register. He's also going to prepare a bunch of magic states and ancilla states and a teleport through authenticate and deauthenticate states. And of course, his classical one-time program to kind of process keys and measurement results, decode measurement results, and to take into account these teleportation measurements. Okay, so then just one final note here. So after deauthentication, for an honest receiver, the final state is actually encrypted by a random poly but no longer encoded. So the classical one-time program will reveal this final decryption poly only if all the reported measurement results were actually consistent with the internal secret key held by the classical one-time program. And this is kind of the way that this one-time program kind of like protects against cheating. All right. So like basically the assumption is that if all the results are consistent, then the user must have been honest. The receiver must have been honest. Okay, so that's basically it in a nutshell. So now I want to say a few words about why this is secure, hopefully without bogging us too much down in detail. So recall, in order to establish security then of these one-time programs, we had this simulation-based definition of security where we have to simulate this bubble with something like this that uses only an idealized call to this functionality. Okay, so in lieu of some nasty symbols, I'm just going to try and give you a nasty picture and maybe explain hand-wavily how this works. The idea is that the simulator is going to create a bunch of registers that look like real one-time program registers. He's going to hold on to the sender's input for himself, and instead he's just going to create a bunch of dummy zeros that will, you know, in place of the sender's input. The magic states are the same, the ancilla states are the same, the teleport through deauthentication is the same. The teleport through authentication is different now. Instead of being a maximally entangled state this way, it's going to come out here. These are EPR pairs, so that when an honest receiver makes his teleportation measurement, he doesn't teleport through authentication to here. Instead, he teleports up here to something that's held by the simulator. This basically is the receiver's effective input state. Even if he's cheating, he must do something that actually induces some effective input state here. Okay. So you get this state, you apply your idealized channel to it, and then you want to teleport that one back in so that it can be used from the receiver's point of view. And doing so, of course, requires a Bell measurement, which has teleportation results, which must be reported to your now simulated classical one-time program. The rest is easy. You can just simulate the interaction straightforwardly, simulate the actions of this classical one-time program because it's totally independent of the input state and all that stuff. So the idea then is that you insert phi at the beginning and then you do the computation on that. Now, you might think that we're doing phi once at the beginning and then doing phi again by actually executing the protocol. So we avoid doing phi twice by actually changing things a little bit. So earlier I stated that we're actually going to implement the circuit that implements phi, but we're actually not going to do quite the circuit that does phi. We'll instead do a controlled unitary, and the simulator will just set the control bit to zero so that, you know, assuming the receiver is honest, then when he actually does this computation protocol with the simulator, he does the identity, so he does nothing. So you get phi once at the beginning here, and then the identity, so you get phi at the end. And of course, a malicious receiver who tries to cheat will still be caught, but, you know, we're just basically replacing phi with the identity, so we can snake in phi at the beginning here. So you kind of like get the input, apply your phi, sneak it back in, and don't do anything at the end. The reason we go through this whole song and dance of trying to do the computation anyway is that it's very difficult to induce a malicious receiver's effective attack because of all this complication with these teleport through authenticate and deauthenticate states. So rather than trying to get some kind of fixed expression for what this attack must look like, it's kind of easier to just kind of mimic the whole protocol as closely as possible. And then that way you know you've kind of, you know, whatever attack he might do throughout this protocol, he must do to the simulator. So that's kind of why we run the whole computation with the identity afterwards. To formalize this is actually quite a bit of a pain because you have so many different registers here and this teleportation really complicates things. So I actually came up with this tabular representation for really large states that, you know, are acted upon by a composition of product operators. Here's your initial state at the beginning, that's a product, and here's like product operators that are applied to it. So this is kind of like just a, you know, this is like a work of art. It just helps you keep track in your head two-dimensionally where what's acting with identity and what's not with each operator. But anyway, I don't get too bogged down in these details. Okay. So kind of that's all I wanted to say about security. So hopefully I've conveyed to you why, at least at a high level, why this is secure. Yes, Daniel.
Yeah, so I'm confused about this. Maybe it's about this controlled by thing. So you're saying that instead of running the circuit for phi, you run the circuit for controlled phi?
Yes.
Which is controlled by a qubit that in the real computation you set to 1?
That's right. So I kind of ignored this detail in the original statement, but what I should have included in addition to these guys is another control qubit that's always set to 1, an authenticator, of course. So phi is a publicly known channel, so the circuit is publicly known. So
wait, phi is publicly known?
Yes, phi is publicly known. The only thing that's secret here, really, is the sender's input.
So then I kind of don't understand the whole model then. I mean, if phi is publicly known, what's to prevent the receiver is the one that you're proving security against the receiver?
Yes.
So and security against the receiver is supposed to say that the receiver can only do this computation once.
Yes. Let me try and say this again. Maybe some intuition can be gleaned from the classical case here. Okay, so the idea is that the only since F is publicly known, the only thing that's really secret here is the sender's input. Now, if you want, you can think of F as kind of like a universal computer, and X is a program that is to be run by F. So
I see. Okay.
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 So,
right. Okay. So then this is the point, is that all the stuff in the simulator depends on this decomposition of phi, but it doesn't depend on the sender's input.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, so since phi is publicly known, then everyone can just agree that we're actually going to implement a controlled unitary and not just a unitary. And yeah. Okay.
But I mean, surely that control can't matter at all, right? I mean,
it doesn't matter. It's an artifact of the fact that we need to construct a simulator. Now, since you bring this up, it's actually possible to do this without having the control unitary, but it complicates the security proof a little bit because you have to do some more checking of the data register at the end, and that just complicates an already complicated analysis. So for the sake of simplifying the analysis, we just added the control bit.
Okay.
It's actually interesting to see. So if you don't have a control bit, if you have a control qubit, all the classical one-time program has to do is make sure that your magic state measurement results are consistent with its internal key. It does not have to check the measurement results for teleporting the data qubits, which is kind of interesting. But if you wanted to get rid of this control qubit, you would then need your classical one-time program to also verify the integrity of the teleportation results for the data register itself, in addition to these magic state registers. It's kind of open whether or not you can get away with not verifying the data measurement results and still not have a control bit. I mean, it seems like you should be able to, but I couldn't quite figure out how to get all the way there. But you know, this is good enough. Okay, so now where was I? Okay, so maybe now is a good time to like pause and see if there are any other questions, because I'd like to kind of shift gears a little bit after this. So what I've done so far is I've introduced quantum one-time programs, I've stated how we construct a one-time program and how an honest receiver would use this one-time program, and I've kind of waved my hands a bit at why this one-time program is secure against a malicious receiver. So now I want to go back and talk a little more about the simulation-based definitions of security, not necessarily restricting to quantum one-time programs now, but any cryptographic protocol, because it's actually a really neat trick, it's a really neat idea. So let's start with some multi-party computation protocol, and the exact details of the protocol aren't important to us right now, but the idea is that, like, so you've got multiple parties and they're going to interact and they're going to perform some computation, and one of these guys, the red guy, is the cheater. Okay, so he interacts with these other honest guys, and at the end of the protocol, he's got some state, and all the knowledge he was able to learn by cheating is contained in that state at the end. So the simulation-based model of security then says, well, if I can recreate that state using only an idealized functionality here, then it must be that the protocol was secure in the sense that this cheater could learn nothing beyond that which could be learned from the idealized functionality. So in other words, rather than executing this real protocol with other people, the cheater might as well have just executed this simulator. Okay, So that's fine. This leads to a weak definition of security called standalone security, where you have the cheater state in the real world and the simulated cheater state in the simulated world, and you say that a protocol is standalone secure if for all cheaters there exists a simulator that can reproduce his state, where the trace distance between these two reproduced states is small. Okay, and that's fine. But why is this weak? Well, what if a protocol is executed more than once? You know? Maybe a cheater could possibly learn something from the first execution of the protocol, which by itself isn't useful, but maybe combined with the subsequent execution kind of unlocks some new information that is useful, right? So this kind of leads you to consider a sequentially repeated protocol now. We don't just have a single state for the cheater, we now have a channel where, like, coming into this channel is whatever he's learned from previous executions of any other protocol. And coming out then is what he's been able to combine in his new knowledge, what knowledge has he been able to gain. Okay, so this leads, like I said, to channels then. So now we want to be able to simulate not a state, but a channel induced by this cheater. So other than that, it's the same. You basically have the same idea, except for now you stick this auxiliary input here, which represents all the information that you might have learned from previous executions of other protocols. Okay, so this leads to sequential definition of security, which is a little bit stronger. It says that now instead of states, we have channels, but everything else is the same. Okay, so a protocol is sequentially secure if for all cheaters there's a simulator such that the distance between these two channels, as measured by the Diamond norm, is small. Now, you might wonder whether these are actually the same model of security. It turns out that they are different. There exist cryptographic protocols that are standalone secure but not sequentially secure. They're kind of contrived for this purpose, but it does demonstrate that these models of security are different. But this isn't quite the holy grail. There could be more, right? What if two protocols are executed in parallel? All right? So here now, you've got one cheater, he's taking part in two protocols simultaneously, and there's multiple rounds of interaction in these protocols. And maybe he might be able to, you know, use information he's learned partway through one to unlock some information halfway through another one, right? So now, we have not a state, not a channel, but a whole strategy here with multiple inputs and outputs in a sequential order. So what we would like then is that I should be able to just unplug this guy and replace it with this guy, who's a simulator that makes only one call to the idealized functionality. And if these two bubbles are completely indistinguishable to any interacting party here, then we have our simulation-based definition of security. So now, instead of distinguishing between states or channels, we're trying to distinguish between strategies, or we're trying to exhibit two strategies that are very close or indistinguishable. So this leads to this definition of universal composability, which is the strongest notion of security that anyone has been able to think about so far. And the idea is that you've got a strategy now induced by the protocol in the real world, and you've got you want to have a simulator that can recreate that strategy. And so I'm going to kind of put forward this new definition of universal composability that says a protocol is universally composable if there exists a simulator that can simulate the honest parties such that these two strategies, the distance between them is small, as measured by this funky norm here, that's a subscript diamond R. Now this is I've called this the strategy R norm. Now this norm has only ever appeared in one paper by me, so I wouldn't expect you to know about it. But this, suffice it to say that this norm captures the distinguishability of strategies in the same sense that the diamond norm captures the distinguishability of channels, or the trace norm captures the distinguishability of states. And the subscript R refers to the number of rounds in the interaction of the strategies that you're dealing with here. Once again, there exist protocols that are sequentially secure but not universally composable, and so this is a strictly stronger definition of security. So we have here three flavors of security. We've got standalone security. This was the first one based on the trace norm. It's like chocolate, vanilla, and strawberry ice cream. So if standalone is the worst one, that's chocolate. Okay, and then sequential is a little bit better, that's vanilla. It's pretty good. And then like universally composable, that's like the holy grail. That's strawberry ice cream. That's really good.
I think you have it
backwards. Yeah. No. You're all wrong. You think I'm itching for a fight here? Okay. So just some notes here then. So, of course, this is not the original definition of universal composability. This was proposed, roughly a decade ago. But the original definition is quite complicated. So this new definition invokes this strategy formalism that was introduced by myself and my graduate advisor, and also by Chilba, Dariano, and Perignotti in 2008. So it kind of, thinking about these protocols in terms of one block of strategies is kind of, it seems a little bit more intuitive to me at least. So unfortunately, our security proof for quantum one-time programs does not invoke the strategy formalism. I thought about it for a little bit, but I couldn't see any obvious advantage of doing so, and so we didn't really want to complicate the proof any further by doing this. So what we did is basically we brute forced it. We just kind of like said, like, here's any interaction, anything interacting with this strategy must have this form, and we just kind of plugged in the two strategies and showed that this, at the end of the interaction, the states must be the same, and so they're indistinguishable. But that's a brute force way of doing it. There's some stuff that's known about these strategies that can sometimes lead to shortcuts that could dramatically simplify some security proofs. Employ a brilliant phrase from one of my fellow postdocs there. There's potential here for a dramatic simplification of universal composability via the strategy formalism, which one could refer to it as a drive-by shooting. Okay. So that's security. So now I'm going to move on to another topic. So are there any more questions about security before I move on? Yes.
Would the strategy formalism extend to computational security?
I don't see why not.
Well, because diamond norm is statistical. I don't see any.
Well, okay, so for computational security, you have to talk about not just one specific instance of the protocol, but a family of protocol that has some uniformity constraints. But you can talk about computationally indistinguishable channels. In fact, this is what Watrous does in his statistical zero knowledge paper. So you just have a family of channels now such that, so you're no longer using the diamond norm. You're just saying there's a polynomial time uniform distinguishing procedure. So I guess you'd no longer use the strategy norm, but you would still use a polynomial time uniform distinguishing strategy now.
I've never really studied this, but my impression is that UC is complicated primarily for computational security, that information security is not so bad. But for computational security, you have to be really careful because you want to make sure the simulator doesn't have extra computational power that you're sneaking in somehow. There's issues like that I've never really looked into.
Now admittedly, a lot of the complication comes from the fact that they tried to make it extremely general to apply to any protocol with some arbitrary, abstract, idealized functionality. And often things become simpler when you just restrict attention to one protocol with a specific idealized functionality. And like you say, this polynomial time computation also affects it. To be honest, I haven't really looked into it that deeply either, but that's the impression I got too. Maybe the simplification offered by using the strategy formalism here wouldn't quite be so dramatic, but I don't know, like even if you just restrict attention to the information theoretic case, I mean, this, the formalism of UC is still pretty complicated. You've got like these session IDs and these message IDs, and you're passing messages around, and like someone has to have control of the system. It's just, I don't know, it's very daunting, at least at first glance, to try and comprehend all this, when really you're just, really at the end of the day, you're just talking about plugging in one strategy for another and like having them indistinguishable. So at least to me, that seems more intuitive. So anything else? Okay, so it's 3:23 here, so I don't know how long we have this room, but maybe I'll just keep going until someone tells me to stop. Okay, so there's one detail about one-time programs that I kind of just conveniently ignored. We spent all this time talking about the need for secure hardware assumptions and all these complicated constructions of one-time programs, but in fact, there do exist functions that admit trivial one-time programs with no hardware assumptions at all. Okay? Consider this function f, which just takes these two strings and treats them as integers and computes the sum. Okay? This function admits a one-time program without any hardware assumptions. And the one-time program is for the sender to simply transmit in the clear his input to the receiver. So you might think, how could this possibly be a one-time program? Well, it's one time in the sense that there exists a simulator that uses only one-shot access to this guy that can actually perfectly recreate this particular program state. So it's really only one time because you can recover all the information you need to know about the sender's input by one query to this function. Okay? So in this case, by just sticking in a zero here, you get x. You get the sender's input. Okay, so this is your simulator. So it meets the formal definition of a one-time program, but it doesn't satisfy our intuition of a one-time program. But I don't think there's anything that any way you possibly could satisfy that intuition for a function as simple as the sum like this, where all the information about the sender's input is can be gleaned from the output. Right? But this does lead to an interesting question, which it's kind of funny that no one has ever thought about this before, because people have considered one-time programs, and you kind of only think about this when you try and formalize the fact that one-time programs are impossible without hardware assumptions. So we did that, and we stumbled on this. So we call a function unlockable if there exists a special input for the sender and a recovery algorithm such that the value of a function f can be recovered by just sending in this special key input for the sender here, right? So in the sum, it's just this input would be the zero input, or any other input, really. Okay, so we prove, we actually give a tight characterization of exactly which functions admit trivial one-time programs without any hardware assumptions. And that is if and only if f is unlockable. Okay? So that's interesting, but we have to remember that we're only talking about a kind of pathological class of functions here. It's interesting from a mathematical perspective, but you know, not necessarily from a more practical perspective. But you know, following this interest in mathematics here to the quantum case, the situation actually becomes much more interesting. We don't have a tight characterization, but we think we know what it is. So we actually define two notions of unlockability for quantum channels. So the first one is a straightforward generalization of unlockability for classical functions. So you say a channel phi is strongly unlockable if there exists a key state and then a recovery channel that can recover the action of phi by just putting in this fixed state here like this. Okay? We also give this other definition, which we call weakly unlockable, if there exists a key channel now, not a state, but a channel that you can put before here such that you can recover the action of phi composed of any local channel on the receiver's local, the receiver's portion of the input state here. So there must exist some recovery algorithm which could depend on this local channel used by the receiver.
Sorry, I'm confused how these correspond to the classical version of unlockable.
So this one should correspond directly. So you've got some fixed input y naught here that you go in here, and then you can then recover the value f.
But rho is the...
rho is your x and y. And so, psi is your
I see. Rho is supposed to be x and y.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a little bit easier in the classical case because everything is separable.
Right.
Or product
right.
state.
Okay.
Okay. This guy, the intuition behind it isn't quite so clear. We kind of stumbled on it quite by accident. So maybe I can explain. Like, it may seem weird that we consider all possible local operations on the receiver's input portion, but it's, you can kind of see that if you don't do that, if you just, you know, eliminate that requirement, then it is trivial to see that every channel is weakly unlockable, because this guy can just, you know, pipe his input in through there, which you would then just, this guy would be the identity, right? But in order to make this interesting, we want some fixed channel. We want to be able to use some fixed channel to kind of, and we want to be able to retroactively apply some arbitrary channel psi here before you pipe in this input through B. Okay, so.
And the point is that.
The point is we want an interesting non-trivial class of channels.
Yeah, no, I'm just trying to say that the classical unlockability kind of corresponds to both of them in the sense that
yes, they are equivalent
because they're separable. That kind of, well, the psi can always be, well, replace this input with this other input.
Yes.
And that's kind of what corresponds to RC. Okay.
Yes, these two notions are equivalent for classical functions. Okay, so we have two theorems then. The first one is the easy one. It says if phi is strongly unlockable, then it emits a quantum one-time program with no hardware assumptions. And it's quite easy to see that if you just, it just takes a moment to chunk through the definitions of a quantum one-time program. So, I mean, first of all, the sender and the simulator are actually exactly the same. The sender just prepares this key state and puts it through here and then provides the output to the receiver, who can then run this recovery algorithm to get the action of the state. And or the action of the channel. And the simulator does exactly the same thing, because the sender's preparation procedure used only an idealized call to this channel phi. Okay? So no hardware assumptions needed. This is akin to the sum function for classical one-time programs. Kind of trivial channel here. Conversely, if phi admits a quantum one-time program with no hardware assumptions, then we can show that phi must be at least weakly unlockable. Okay, so this takes a little more thought. I mean, again, it's not overly complicated. It's just kind of getting your head around all these definitions. So I'm going to try and work through this. Hopefully I can explain this in a way that makes sense. So the idea is that we're assuming that phi admits a quantum one-time program. So that means that these things must be true. There must exist some channel that the sender can do on his input to create a program state here. This is what we call this the encoding channel. And then some decoding channel that the receiver can do to recover the action of phi. Okay, so this is just what a quantum one-time program without any hardware assumptions must look like. And down here, then, there must exist a simulator, by definition, that has this form, where a simulator with no hardware assumptions can only do this. It can only pre-process the receiver's input, make an idealized call to this, and then post-process it. And without loss of generality, we can assume that the simulator actually recreates perfectly the program state created here. So this channel is equivalent to this channel here without the decode at the end. Right? That's just the definition of a one-time program. Okay, so given those things, we want to show that phi is at least weakly unlockable. Okay, so I'm going to have to flip back and forth between two slides here. So we claim that phi is weakly unlockable with this choice of key channel, SIM1, and this choice of recovery channel for any channel, local channel psi here. So this is really just plugging things in and chugging through. So recall what we have to show. Oops. We have to show that for that choice of key channel and recovery operation, this guy equals phi compulsive psi. So let's start by substituting in the definitions of these guys. We've got A is given by this composition, that's these guys, then a phi, then a psi naught, which is just this guy. Right? So we've got this composition of five channels here. Now, by definition, sim1, phi, sim2, well, that's just our simulator that recreates the program state here. Sim1, phi, sim2, that recreates this guy. This is the same as the encoding channel. So we can replace those three. Replace these three guys with the encoding channel. You've got decode, psi, encode, but encode acts only on the sender's input. Psi is a local channel for the receiver's input, so these guys commute. So we've got decode encode, but that's just phi. So we've got phi composed of psi. Done. Okay? So what we've shown then is that phi must be weakly unlockable. Okay, so this is kind of neat. Okay, so now finally, we conjecture that you can actually close this loop, that any channel that is weakly unlockable is also strongly unlockable. And I think I know how to show this, but I don't really have the requisite knowledge on invertible subspaces of a channel that I think are required to prove this. But maybe I'll wave my hands for the next few minutes and kind of hopefully convey some intuition as to how someone might do this, and then we'll stop the talk there. Okay, so recall these are the two definitions of this is strongly unlockable, this is weakly unlockable. So we want to let phi be a weakly unlockable channel, and we want to show that it's actually strongly unlockable. So since this weak unlockability property holds for arbitrary local operations psi here, we can choose a specific psi that does this. It does not put the sender's portion B through here, it just passes it right through and instead creates some dummy state, which we call xi, and puts that in. Okay, you can do that. That's fine. Okay. So for that particular choice of psi, it must be that this channel is the identity on B, because B just goes all the way through here untouched. Right? So then that must mean that these two are invertible on B. Well, if this composition of channels is invertible on B, well, first of all, we can assume that this guy is actually an isometry by just expanding the dimension of this guy. You can assume without loss of generality that that guy is an isometry. And so really, this guy induces a subspace of this space here upon which phi must be perfectly invertible, okay? Or decoherence-free, I guess, is the lingo. And that subspace must contain the image of the partial trace of all possible output states here. So the idea is that you should be able to swap out this invertible subspace with a dummy state, and it goes through and it doesn't get touched by phi, and then you swap them back in when you're done, and then whatever dummy state you've plugged through is your initial key state. So that's kind of the intuition, at least, so that this is the key state then that would demonstrate strong unlockability that we require. So that's the intuition. That's how I think you would solve this problem, but I'm not confident enough to claim that we know that this is in fact the case, so I dare you to try and prove me wrong. So I guess that's that problem. So I think that's just about all I had to say. So thank you very much, everyone, for your attention. So I don't know if you're chairing this or anything, or anyone would like to ask questions, or?
I assume if you want to ask questions, they know what to do.
Okay, so hearing no questions, I think I'll just take a seat.
Okay.